Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Dr. Rafael Martinez is among a very small population of Americans who have earned a doctorate degree. That's only 2% of the U.S. population, according to the Brookings Institution. Even among public school principals, only about 10% have PhDs. For Dr. Martinez, now a professor at a major university, the odds were stacked high against him throughout his youth. For most of his life, he was undocumented in a nation that devalued his humanity. His presence in the United States was against the law. Still, he worked hard and studied harder. But all that hard work and dedication to achieve took place in the shadows, always in fear of being caught doing the right thing in the wrong place. That wrong place is the United States. Dr. Martinez is today a part of a population that is categorized as a Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. He is the author of a new book, Illegalized, Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States, published by the University of Arizona Press. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Dr. Rafael Martinez.
Yes, thank you for having me on the show.
So tell me about your current work and how you're feeling about the state of affairs in our society today.
Yes, well, I'm excited to be sharing the book. It just came out a couple of weeks ago, titled Illegalized, Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States. And I'm excited because I think it comes at a timely manner where people are interested, engaged in talking about politics. But of course, one of those leading politics being immigration and the status of immigration in the United States. And every so often, every presidential election, we get back to this idea of, can we pass immigration reform? Can we pass policy that is humane towards immigrant communities? Can we bring them out of the shadows? And I think that my book captures a slice of the efforts that have gone into this movement of changing the way that we talk about immigrant rights, humanizing immigrant rights, and putting a face. That is the work that undocumented youth in the last two decades have been leading in efforts to be able to change the way that the U.S. as a society talks about immigration in this country. And so I think that my book comes at a timely manner and hopefully offer some lessons for us to move forward.
Well, there's so much paradigm-shifting information revealed in your book. But before we get into it, take me back to your first memories as a child and your experiences migrating to the United States.
Yes, well, my family and I migrated to the U.S. when I was only 3 years old, and I celebrated my fourth birthday just 20 days after arriving in the United States. And I remember one of the things that always stood with me in my mind was my parents telling me, "We came to the United States for a better life." And now that's a common phrase that most immigrant families hear in their lifetime. And so it was really odd to me only as a four-year-old and growing up in my childhood. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. If anybody in your listeners know about South Central LA in the early 90s, it was a place that was going through really rough times, including in 1994 when we had the LA riots, or the LA uprising as it's come to be known now, where there was an issue around race and racism and police brutality towards communities of color. And so when I looked outside my window, I saw my neighborhood on fire, literally on fire, to see the demonstrations and protests, the disappointment that residents of LA were feeling at that time. And so for me, those two, that historical moment and the idea that my parents were telling me that we were coming here for a better life didn't seem to match at the time. So I feel like I always grew up with this critical consciousness and idea of, like, what does it mean to be an immigrant in this country? And how is citizenship constructed around the idea of the other, or the immigrant in this case? And I often tell people that when we're talking about immigration, it's not just for immigrant communities, but U.S. citizens need to be paying attention, because the way that immigration is constructed is very much a mirror that showcases the ways that citizenship is constructed around race, gender, sexuality, and many other interlocking identities. And so that was always something that stood with me in the back of my mind, understanding what does a better life mean in the context of U.S. society.
Well, it's interesting because when you talk about citizenship is built around this ideology of belonging. We all belong to a place. And yet, your experience says that you're not wanted here.
Yes. I think that, you know, again, to do a little bit of storytelling, I think we often tell our youth, we often tell our children, what do you want to be when you grow up? Really premised on this idea that if you grow up and you work hard enough, you can accomplish anything. And I remember being told that, but as an immigrant youth growing up in the U.S., you reach all these milestones. Think about getting a driver's license. In California at the time, I couldn't get a driver's license when all my friends in high school were getting driver's licenses. You know, all my friends were talking about going away to college. That's an idea I couldn't fathom. So I named the book Illegalized because I didn't want to just talk about illegality in the sense of the big macro level items, such as the borderlands, immigration, detention, deportation. I also wanted to talk about illegality at the micro level, thinking about everyday actions and how mobility, choice making for undocumented immigrant communities is impacted on an everyday basis, depending on what we have access at the local and state levels. And so for me, as an immigrant youth and many of my peers that we grew up with, it represented everyday actions, everyday choices that we had to make.
My guest is Dr. Rafael Martinez. He is the author of Illegalized, Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States. Dr. Martinez, what roles have distrust, fear, and trauma played in your life experience?
Yes, well, I often talk about the idea of resilience that immigrant populations face in this country as both a positive thing or resilience, right? We build resilience over time, but we also have to talk about it in the negative ways in terms of thinking about the trauma that we prolong and carry over such a long period of time. And just to give you an example, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, that happened or passed in 2012 under President Obama's administration, that gave a pathway to careers and work for many of us, including myself. A fear of deportation. And so we see the difference that that created in a lot of our undocumented youth's lives. But without those placeholders, if you will, undocumented immigrants have to carry that trauma and that decision-making process on an everyday level. And so that's a trauma that happens over time. That's a fear of going to certain places and all of these different things. Now, again, I also want to highlight the resilience and the positive attribute. Oftentimes, I have been told by friends and colleagues, wow, you're so well organized. You stay on top of everything. How do you do that? And I said, well, the immigration system does that to you. When you have to plan your life in these two-year blocks and these different immigration life cycle blocks, you have to really be a good planner and make sure that you have all your documents, all your materials together because of that same fear that we carry, right? And so I think that we have to see that fear through this double-edged sword in a form of resilience and the positive attributes that come with that, but also thinking about, of course, how trauma gets extended over a person's lifetime. And even when we do achieve immigration status or citizenship, I think those traumas still go past that because I know some of my friends and family members who now have citizenship, they still carry those actions and those fears in certain ways when they have to meet, forms of authority, including policing and other forms of authority in this country.
Yeah, it sounds like it's kind of ingrained in your daily life and a way of coping. You develop these skills. How did you transition from undocumented to documented?
Yes, well, I always describe my life as being two different, places or two different experiences. My youth that was spent in California was completely undocumented. And then when I transitioned into graduate school, applying for my master's program and PhD programs, that was all with DACA status. I entered my master's program in the fall of 2012 at the University of New Mexico, right when DACA was announced. And so really, it was a completely different life story. My experience in LA looks very different than my experience in New Mexico did, simply because of the access that DACA offered. Right away, I was able to get a driver's license in the state of New Mexico. I was able to get jobs or employed on campus that not only were offered me funding, of course, but also trained me in my profession and my career path. And so that led to a level of, career development. It led to economic prosperity. For the first time, I had access to healthcare right? And so I was able to visit a doctor. Imagine showing up to the doctor's office, you're 27, 28 years old, and I'm asking you when was the last time you went in for a visit, and you're saying, I can't remember. That's the type of level of access and creation that DACA offered undocumented youth. 800,000 people benefiting at the height of the program, currently at about 500,000 undocumented youth that are benefiting from the program. And so when we talk about creating access, it impacts every aspect of your life, not just for the individual, but also for the families, because now that individual has access to economic opportunities that also get extended onto mixed status families and be able to become a support system for our families as well.
And that's a support system and benefit to the community and to society at large. Talk about mapping undocumented youth studies, which you talk about in your book.
Yes, well, I wanted to show that there was this need to really focus on undocumented youth, because undocumented youth are changing how we think about social movements in the United States history. I think undocumented youth have come to represent hope, aspiration, in terms of social movement, mass movement building in the United States that are coming from the civil rights period into the present day. And also thinking about academic studies like archiving. What do archives look like? And so I talk about this idea of undocumenting as a way in which undocumented youth and their social movement organizing began to imagine new ways of documenting their social movements and taking their activism to sites and where they could go ahead and counter some of the discourse, the rhetoric that the U.S. government was saying at the time. For example, the movements that I cover happened at a time where heightened deportation and detentions were happening in the U.S. government, when the U.S. government were saying that they only detained and deported high criminal offenses, and immigrant communities knew that simply wasn't real. So undocumented youth wanted to take their activism to those sites where this was happening by infiltrating detention centers as a form of documenting the human rights violations that were happening inside of the detention centers, and then being able to expose and really showing the documentation of what was happening in these sites. What that did is it allowed us to have records and real information about what was happening to immigrant bodies in these locations, and then being able to change the discourse of how we talk about immigrant rights and how we talk about the immigration system. And so my framework of undocumenting really allows this idea of focusing and centering undocumented youth as knowledge producers, both in the context of U.S. society, but also talking about why there's an importance to studying undocumented youth in these different realms.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of courage among these youth to not only infiltrate these systems that are causing trauma and harm, but to bring that to the attention of the public, but at the same time, expose themselves.
Yes, I always highlight that obviously these undocumented youth activists put themselves at risk, knowing that they might be detained and deported. However, they were also banking on the idea that by 2010, 2011, when these actions that I write about are happening, that undocumented youth had reached unprecedented levels of cultural capital that is very much well-known and visibility in the public eye. We use this term, the dreamer identity, as like a common household name that people know undocumented youth as, oh, yes, they should be included. There's a favorable opinion by the U.S. public about undocumented youth through this identifier. And so undocumented youth realized that this was an opportunity that they, if they were to push their activism to civil disobedience forms, then they would not be detained and deported, because then they would create a precedent in where the U.S. government would seem very unfavorable in U.S. public opinion by deporting these undocumented youth who were seen as deserving and favorable by the U.S. public. And that's, in fact, what happened with most of the actions that I write about.
Dr. Martinez, we were diving into the process of collecting information on undocumented youth studies and the courage that it took for undocumented youth to elevate awareness of the systemic trauma and harm that was being done by these systems. So you were saying, Dr. Martinez, about the courage that these youth had expressed and what their hope was. Please continue.
Yes, I had mentioned the idea that undocumented youth used their visibility and cultural capital that they had gained by 2010 in the United States, and they went ahead and exchanged this cultural capital, banking on the idea that they would not be detained and deported, even if they pushed their activism to these different sites that were rendering undocumented communities as illegal or criminal, and exposing the reality of what was happening to immigrant bodies in these places. And so, in fact, most of the history that I show and the movements that I show, that's in fact what happened. Most of these folks would not be deported. It was actually shown that the U.S. government considered them a biggest threat by exposing and showing the realities of what was happening in these places. And most of the time, they were not arrested, detained, and deported. They were simply let go after these actions because, again, the U.S. government felt that if they detained and deported these folks, it would be seen as a very much in a public outcry for taking those actions against undocumented youth.
Well, your book is more than just data and case studies. It's also stories. Tell me about Elvira Arellano, and why is her story important in undocumented youth movements nationwide?
Yes, Elvira's story is really important because I see her as a figure that was an example to undocumented youth to show the possibilities of what can happen when you control the narrative, the storytelling, the discourse about immigrant and mixed status families. And so she was a figure that took sanctuary, meaning that she took refuge inside of a Chicago church from 2006 to 2007 for a whole year, instead of being served a deportation notice that she had received for working with false documents, as most undocumented immigrants sometimes are forced to do so. And so what was neat about her activism was that for the first time in the sanctuary movement that stems back to the 1980s, she took the cameras and the media inside of her intimate space inside of the Chicago church to being able to show people how she lived, how she continued to parent her child on a daily basis, who was a U.S. citizen, and the forces or the push that the U.S. government was forcing her to live in these conditions simply for trying to be a good mother and, you know, raise her U.S. citizen children in this particular way. And so when undocumented youth saw that the power of collecting these stories and being able to show and control the narrative, it took it to heights unimaginable. She became Time Magazine's most influential person, I think, by 2007. And so we see that the media really paid attention to the way that she was controlling the narrative and the storytelling. That gave a roadmap for undocumented youth that if they control the narrative, if they use the growth of social media effectively, they too can take these stories to unprecedented heights and, again, exchange those stories to be able to organize in these civil disobedience manners and take their activism to new heights.
So it sounds like narrative matters. And the folks who are reframing undocumented people as unwanted people, as illegal people, as criminal people, as people to fear, those folks who are creating those frames, those narratives, those folks are running for office. They're holding office. They're wielding power. How do you address that? How do you combat that?
Yes, narrative matters, storytelling matters. And that's why I wrote this book, to make it accessible to any audiences who care about the topic, but who want to learn through storytelling formats on how undocumented immigrant communities are contributing members of our society at every single level, right? And one of the ways that I did that is through, again, the idea of illegality or illegalized, begging the question, if undocumented communities are simply trying to exist and contribute to society in these different ways, it begs the question, are these undocumented communities the ones that are being criminal or committing criminal acts? Or is it the U.S. government who it goes to an extent to document, to paint, to control the narrative of showing undocumented immigrant communities as criminal? It begs the question, who is the criminal and who's taking criminal action in this instance? And that's through the activism and documentation that we see the extent to which the U.S. government is using resources, funding, and support with U.S. tax dollars to go ahead and control the narrative of undocumented immigrants as criminal in many formats when the reality shows otherwise, and the stories that I present humanize immigrants and humanize immigration in a completely different manner.
It's interesting because it reminds me of the civil rights movement when there was civil disobedience to bring light to the evils of the lawmakers, and that required the lawbreakers to demonstrate a certain amount of courage that put them in harm's way. Talk about Jonathan Perez and Isaac Barrera's activist efforts in exposing the hidden world of detention and deportation.
Yes, Jonathan Perez and Isaac Barrera were two folks who were working with a network of immigrant rights organizations with ally lawyers. And what they wanted to do was to create the scenario, again, showing their bravery, where they could be detained and placed inside of a detention center to be able to infiltrate or document the real experiences of what were happening inside of detention centers. Once they were inside, they were able to talk to folks in detention, collect their stories, collect their information in terms of their case numbers. They were able to call outside the detention center, which requires a lot of funds and a lot of planning for an action like this. The audio recordings or the conversations were being audio recorded and then disseminated through social media and other media platforms to be able to showcase, again, the stories of people inside of the detention center. When these actions happened in 2011, we had an idea that there was human rights violations, sexual harassment, and many other injustices happening inside of the detention center. But again, we didn't have the records, the direct proof. And so they wanted to create a scenario where they could put themselves inside of these detention centers, again, risking deportation, but with the efforts of exposing what was really happening inside of detention centers. Well, they only lasted about 20 days in detention, and they were seen as a bigger threat inside of that detention center because, again, they were organizing and showcasing, exposing the different lies that were going on by the U.S. government. And so, you know, this really showed a moment where there was an alternative way of organizing, even if it meant, you know, risking deportation in this case. And this is the effect that undocumented youth had to take their activism to these levels to be able to showcase those vulnerable situations in which undocumented immigrants are placed on an everyday basis.
My guest is Dr. Rafael Martinez. He is the author of Illegalized, Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States. Dr. Martinez, what does it mean to be an undocu-scholar?
It means that we take our lived experiences and being able to exchange that or produce scholarship, public work that is able to present an alternative as the youth that I write about show about immigration. It means that we take our scholarship, our information, and produce works that everyday people, the general audience, the U.S. society can engage with and learn from to be able to think about immigration in a different way in this country.
Now talk about the event Coming Out of the Shadows and what it meant to you and other scholars doing research.
Coming Out of the Shadows, the first one was organized in 2010. In Chicago. It happened in downtown Chicago in a very public, busy section of the city. And it was really a watershed moment because it changed, again, the possibility of creating space for other undocumented youth to feel comfortable with identifying as undocumented youth, sharing their status openly. And why would people do that? Well, like the queer movement and the civil rights movement period with LGBTQ rights, coming out of the closet created a space where people could feel comfortable in their identities and organize, cultivate community, But also, that happened on a conversation internally to undocumented youth, but externally, it was also a way to build mass movement building of allies who said, yes, we are invested on the idea of protecting our undocumented immigrant communities, and they should feel comfortable in our cities in very public ways, and we're going to be able to support them. That is activism. That is energy that carried into educational spaces where those conversations happen for higher education for undocumented youth. It carried on to lawyers who were doing pro bono work with many of these immigrant communities. It carried on into the health field and so forth, so forth, to the point where we see these actions really materialize into the possibilities, crafting spaces. People begin to ask themselves, how can I support undocumented youth? And undocumented youth said, how can we create spaces to continue to push access to these different resources, not only for the movement, but also, again, for individuals' life and the betterment of our undocumented immigrant communities?
Well, you write about a post-Trump American society. What do you imagine that looks like?
That's a really big question, thinking about the election right now. I think that, you know, one of the things that these movements highlight and what I write in the book is that thinking about different political parties, the idea is not necessarily the candidates themselves, but really the issue is the immigration system as an institution in which it's produced. Oftentimes we hear the idea that the immigration system's not working, but oftentimes scholars like myself included would say that the system is working as it was meant to be working in place, which is the criminalization of these bodies and immigrants at the expense of making capital or capital production. And so as long as these systems exist for capital accumulation for the U.S. government, for private entities and businesses in this country, as the detention center has become a big item of funding, of making money, right, of investments, then these systems will continue to happen no matter who's in the White House. And so I think that undocumented youth have realized that we need to put pressure on all political parties and all candidates, because without it, the immigration system reform will not change. And that's where we need change, not in this simply just policy, because if we pass policy, then the day of tomorrow, we're going to continue 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we're going to continue in some of these same debates.
It sounds like you're looking for a paradigm shift in Americans' thought process about immigrants and about humanity and about the value of humanity. We have about a minute left. Can you tell me, what is the National Immigrant Youth Alliance?
Yes, NIYA was an organization that was formed in 2011. It was a conglomerate of organizations that came together. Now, one of the things that's neat about this organization at its height is that it never really was created as an organization that was meant to exist long-term, but again, created for short-term civil disobedience actions. And that's what it was effective in doing, being able to disrupt these systems that were criminalizing immigrant communities. And so that's one of the legacies of the organization. The organization no longer exists or is in effect, but the legacy of it was that it showed how flexible organizations can be if they are produced to produce this short-term form of disrupting immigration systems that are criminalizing immigrant bodies. And that left a legacy for, or a blueprint, if you will, for other activism, other social movements to think about movement building in these particular ways.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you, Dr. Martinez, for your important work and your courage to try and change the conditions in our society for the betterment of all who live here. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest was Dr. Rafael Martinez, author of Illegalized: Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States.